Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. How you doing? I'm Renee Powers, and I'm the founder of Feminist Book Club. These are weird times, and they are wild, and we're experiencing something completely new, but I am not going to dwell on that today, because it continues to cause a lot of anxiety for me, and I'm sure for others. So on this podcast, as well as on our social media, we will limit the amount of pandemic mentions. Instead of preaching to the choir about social distancing and flattening the curve, you can count on us and our social media to be a space for lighthearted content, especially our Instagram stories. I'm putting a lot of effort into that these days. So make sure you weigh in on those questions and our polls. Our podcast will continue uninterrupted as well, and unless the author brings it up, we won't be discussing the pandemic either. We're not putting our heads in the sands here. We're providing a safe, comforting space for you to escape to if you need it. So let's change gears and talk about our April subscription box, which will still be going out as planned. As you likely know already, our book club is a true book club. Every month, members vote on a book and we discuss it in our online group and on video chat. We've been meeting virtually since before it was cool. Members can choose from a few different membership levels, and our most popular by far is definitely the subscription box. So along with the book of the month, you'll receive 2 to 4 products from woman and queer-owned businesses. Our April theme is Women in Nature. Our book of the month is These Witches Don't Burn by Isabel Sterling. And we revealed our first product last week on last week's episode, which will be handcrafted facial serum from Sweet Girl Farm. On our Instagram, we revealed our second product, reusable silicone straws with their own little carrying cases from the company Go Silly. We will reveal 2 more products over the next couple of days over on Instagram, and our email subscribers will be the first to know what is in the entire box. They'll see the full reveal this weekend, so make sure you are on that list. All of our membership options are listed on feministbookclub.com/shop, and as always, please reach out if you have any questions. I am so thrilled to be talking to today's guest, Erica T. Worth, about her writing career, the language we use to describe our identities, the Native American film writing and arts communities, and so much more. I loved her collection of short stories called Buckskin Cocaine, but there are links to all of her books and all other books mentioned in the show notes, so check those out. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Today, I am chatting with Erica T. Worth. Erica's publications include 2 novels, Crazy Horse's Girlfriend and You Who Enter Here, 2 collections of poetry, and a collection of short stories called Buckskin Cocaine, which we'll be talking about today. A writer of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, she teaches creative writing at Western Illinois University and has been a guest writer at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in numerous journals, including BuzzFeed, Boulevard, The Writer's Chronicle, Waxwing, and The Kenyon Review. She will be a faculty at Breadloaf in 2020, is a Kenyon Review Writers Workshop scholar, and attended the Ten House Summer Workshop, and has been chosen as a narrative artist for the Meow Wolf Denver installation. She is Apache, Chickasaw, Cherokee, and was raised outside of Denver. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to talk to you about this book. It's so, so moving. I ask everyone at the beginning, though, what is your definition of feminism?
You know, it's really funny. My stepson, my eldest, a couple years ago, asked me in this sort of hilariously pointed way. He's like, "Are you a feminist?" And, he was clearly feeling it out. And maybe it's the first time he'd heard that word. And it's something that very early on I identified with. And I had had like an article about Thelma Louise from Glamour magazine, like tacked over my bed when I was a kid. And then I'd been kind of introduced to the idea of womanism, right? So it's sort of like, it sounds way too simplistic, but it's feminism for women of color. In other words, it's inclusive, it's inclusive, hopefully, of queerness and inclusive of all these different issues. Like, if you're a Black woman, you're obviously dealing with, racism potentially. If you're a Native American woman, you're dealing with issues of sovereignty. And so it's the idea that, like, it's not all one size fit all. fits all, but I think ultimately it means, and it's now more and more inclusive as gender and sexuality are kind of like taken apart and dissected and kind of rearranged. I think it simply just means equality as far as I'm concerned. And that's how I've tried to define it for my stepson. But when I went off into that, he was like, I don't, okay, are you or are you not? You know, and I still don't know what that means. Yeah.
So have you moved away from using womanist?
No, I think it's a thing in context. I think it's, feminism is one of those words, I think it's an automatic go-to. And it was kind of, I mean, not hilariously, but in a sort of dark way, hilariously demonized for so long. And I think womanist and womanism is simply just not in the vocabulary, and maybe it just should be. So oftentimes it's a matter of like, feminism is my go-to word, and womanism is something that I often use in context.
Mm. I know that the term womanism comes out of Black feminist thought, and so does intersectional feminism. I don't know if we want to get into this, but can you kind of suss out what the differences might be for our audience who may not know or may not be familiar with either term?
I think that I'm certainly not the expert. You know, like I said, I do consider myself, I guess, you know, a lot of times, so women's departments, even in universities, are not women's departments anymore. They're, you know, departments of gender and sexuality. And I think that makes sense. I think there's just so much happening so quickly to acknowledge the extreme gender and sexual diversity that I feel like I'm not, since this isn't my specialty, I'm the worst person qualified to do that. But I will say that what a lot of Native and especially Latinx people have been talking about is that we're constantly borrowing from Black feminism. So maybe that's a problematic issue with the word womanist right there, is that we need to cut it out. We need to stop being like someone was saying, as a poet, Angelica Vanessa Villarreal, I always get her name wrong. She was like, we need to stop taking phrases like Black don't crack, which is just, you know, kind of like a colloquialism, and saying beige don't fade, or, you know, like constantly taking their bits and pieces and just sort of like Latinxing them or Native Americaning in them. And I agree. So I want to say there are people, there are Native American scholars that probably could talk about this better than me. And I don't know who their names are, but you know, I'm not sure I'm the guy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those questions. I don't think that we're going to get to the answer to it today or next week or next month either. I think that we are constantly grappling with what the kind of boundaries of feminism are, if there are boundaries of it, and then what it looks like when applied in everyday life, when our everyday lives look so different person to person. So I'm always curious about the terms people use and why they choose to use them. And that's why I always ask, what is your definition of feminism? Because it is so personal for so many of us.
Yeah.
So moving on, you've mentioned that you're Native American. And as I know that a lot of our audience is, I've said this before, I will say it again, and I'll stand by it, a bunch of well-meaning white women. Mm-hmm. What I want to ask you as we record to demonstrate how or how not to pose this question, what is your preferred language around Native American, American Indian, Indigenous people, and why?
That's, you know, I think, that's another one that's extremely individual, at least I'm at least partially qualified to speak to, because for example, I'm descended from three tribes. My dad was white and I'm urban. And so people still want to be like, Erica, you're from the reservation. You're from the reservation. You're from the reservation. And you know, Native Americans are understandably extremely territorial. And there are all kinds of extremely good reasons for that. Like number one being genocide, you know? And so I think like, I'm going to answer that I like Native and I don't mind Indian, but there are a lot of people, like for example, in Canada, you know, First Nations, some people like, some people really hate that and they much prefer Indigenous. Indigenous always makes me feel kind of like a plant, you know, and that's not altogether bad, but I'm not sure I feel comfortable with it. A lot of people, for example, if you're from Dene Ta or you're from the Navajo Nation, like the Dene Nation, you know, they prefer Dene. I don't know if in the mainstream culture that has been successful in terms of the mainstream understanding, like say Dene, not Navajo, but it can happen. For example, I think a lot of people who are not Lakota now know, say, to say Lakota instead of Sioux. And so I think for me, it's more problematic because I grew up with more Lakota and Dene and Oki Mixes and Anishinaabe than I grew up with the people who are Chickasaw and Apache. And so I don't feel like I think the word Pan-Indian, there are all kinds of bad connotations to it that it deserves. But for me, it kind of works because that's how I grew up and that's how I identify. And I grew up going to powwow. Native American church was around me and things that are very urban. And I'm okay with that. But there are people who are going to say, well, Indians say Indian. And that's just not true because it varies. It varies from tribe to tribe and nation to nation. And, you know, and so I think that's really problematic. I don't think you can go wrong with Native American. But do Native Americans generally use that? We use that amongst ourselves? Usually not. So
thank you for just going there with us, because I know that can be really difficult for a lot of people to say, well, how do you identify, or what is the language that you use? And again, it's so personal. So I ask that, like I said, I ask that on air because I think a lot of people, well-meaning white women especially, are afraid to ask that and don't want to make a mistake. And we have to be willing to go out on a limb and be brave and make mistakes. And that's the only way we can learn. So shifting gears, I want to talk about your writing. I've said on the show before that short stories is one of my favorite genres or formats, I suppose. Right. I know it can cross. And so when you said, well, what do you want to talk about? And I said, oh, I really want to talk about Buckskin Cocaine because it's so, there's so much to it. Can you give our audience just a brief description of this book?
Sure. I mean, look, and it's, you know, Buckskin Cocaine, it's interesting because it's done really, really, really well with two groups of people who kind of like the more avant-garde stuff, which, you know, I'm somebody who I like form and I'm a form hound. So I love traditional storytelling. And I don't mean like around a campfire. I mean like, you know, plot that's very structured. And I also love things that are avant-garde if they're really purposeful and there's an intent to them. And Buckskin Cocaine is really avant-garde and it's done well with those folks. And interestingly enough, with middle-class Indians who are in the arts or the intellectual, you know, in academia, because they kind of are like, oh wow, this is about Indians for Indians. And it's not trying to teach about a culture. It's not trying to pander to anything. It's not, there are no lessons for white people in this book. And it's funny because all that it really is about is like the Native American film world from the inside, right? It's about directors and about actors and about writers turned, you know, screenplay writers, and what that can be like from the inside, and like how brutal the film world can be and how brutal and beautiful and wonderful the Native world can be. But when you combine those things, it can be especially brutal. And I was really interested in like trying to represent what people's inner monologues look like. If you could kind of talk sort of more honestly almost to yourself than you ever would to anyone or even to yourself consciously, what would that look like? And in the end, it's kind of this kind of mean book, kind of satirical book, but I really like it anyway.
It's gritty. I don't know if I would call it mean or satirical, but it's gritty and it makes you uncomfortable in all the best ways. Why the film industry? Why did you choose that as the setting for all of these?
Well, I was a guest writer at the Institute of American Indian Arts a long time ago. And I was hanging out in Santa Fe. I lived in Albuquerque because Santa Fe is just too much for me. And it's beautiful, but it's expensive. And it's just, you know, just not, I'm from, you know, the mountains west of Denver. That was too much for me. So I lived in Albuquerque and I commuted, but I still ended up hanging out with a lot of the film people, right? Because at IA, they have a number of trajectories, including creative writing and film. And so those people just kind of end up with each other. And the personalities were so, so compelling, so screwed up, so interesting. And I couldn't help but be haunted by them. Like, you know, 80% of what I wrote was fiction, made up dialogue, inner dialogue. Even the events were occasionally vaguely based off of actual events. But the personalities were the closest to actual personalities I've ever used probably in my life. And they were just, they haunted me. Like I had finished my first novel, Crazy Horse's Girlfriend, and finally sold it to a small press. And I was finally done with it. And I'd written a second collection of poetry. And I think what was happening was my, like the poetry part of me was just sort of dying and becoming something completely different. And I was using poetic techniques when I was writing Buckskin Cocaine. And all of that was kind of sitting on me as I'm sitting back in Macomb, Illinois, after this year in, you know, Santa Fe and Albuquerque, and I just started writing these pieces, and they just sort of kind of, I've always been good at first person point of view, I think, really voice driven stuff. So that's how that came about. And by the way, I do have that long-winded professor plus Native American is just disaster going on. Like, I'm so long-winded. My hashtag is always like, don't give the Indian the mic. So let me know if it's like you need to shut me down. So.
No, I love it. I prefer long-windedness. It's easier for me to edit, on the other hand. But okay, so I have a question that I had written down, and I'm so glad that you provided just a really natural segue to it. That every voice in every story is so unique. Is it difficult to embody those people and write in a completely different voice?
I think that I'm of two minds here. I love the idea, and I think I'm sometimes successful at it, even when it's totally imaginative, at embodying a voice that's not like mine at all, right? But there are times, like, for example, the novel I'm working on now, it was a braided narrative, and this agent I really trust who wanted to assign me but just didn't have time to do the work that the novel clearly needed finally just said, look, you know what? These voices are too alike. I can't. It's just too hard for me. And so there are times when you have to acknowledge, like, I'm not embodying different voices. I'm not successful here. But with Buckskin Cocaine, the personality, like, honestly, I kind of have to give it to them. They were just so absurd. And yet I think, like, human and redeemable, like, you can be an evil character and still be a human being. You know, like the first character, you know, he's obviously pretty disturbed, but he's clearly gone through some stuff as a kid on the reservation. And so you can see, okay, maybe this was maybe not inevitable, but you can understand why he's such a disturbing personality. And so, you know, those particular personalities, yes, they're kind of based on people. But I think you can, you know, you can set down to inhabit a personality and still reflect yourself too much or still not be able to do it. And that's something that I think I have an ability with.
Do you just get in the zone and do you like put on a special hat for a certain character and then like smoke a pipe for another character?
Yeah, I almost pictured myself like, you know, because I do like the hard-boiled detective not like stuff. And so I kind of picture myself like Sherlock Holmes, and that's kind of fun. But you know, with those personalities, they were so compulsive. I don't even know how to explain it. Like, what's kind of funny is that people always act like commercial fiction is really, oh, it's so easy to write. And, you know, if you've gone to MFA school, you've taken creative writing classes, you know that people are like, oh, these commercial novels, this is really easy to write. I'm like, no, they're not. They're not. Having a clearly thought out, structured A-line plot, B-line plot with an inciting incident, genuinely rising action, managing these A-line and B-line plots to an effective climax and a denouement, yeah, okay, there's a pattern to it, but executing it is really, really hard. And so to me, that's the challenge. Writing an avant-garde piece and writing in these people's personalities, because they were short and they were kind of, they spoke to my particular, I think, I don't know how else to put this, but talents. I'm not saying it was easy, but it was probably in some ways the easiest book I've ever written, because it was just the most bizarrely cathartic, strangely easy to inhabit. And I did feel like those personalities while I was writing them. And when I read them, people like Candy Francois, people think I'm her. They actually, and which is kind of simultaneously insulting and flattering, because she's this vacuous model type, right? So people are like, do you still live in New York? After I finish reading it, I'm like, I've never lived in New York. I'm not a model. I'm kind of a slightly overweight middle-aged writer, you know? So yeah, I can understand, and it's flattering that they think that, because right, I clearly was able to inhabit them. And it did feel a bit like that, putting on the hat when I wrote those pieces.
One thing that I really love about it is that, first off, they run from 3 pages to like 50 pages, depending on the character. They are these just beautiful character development snippets with overlapping plot in between them. And so they all, it seems to me like they're all moving around one another in the same world in the film industry. Was that difficult just to create relationships and write in different voices within these relationships chapter by chapter, because it's not a full novel, right? It is short stories.
I think someone, when you know, obviously the native writer that people are like, oh, Sherman Alexie, not good. Okay, how about Tommy Orange? And I actually feel almost sorry for Tommy in that regard, because he's like, I guess I'm it, you know? And I don't think that's his fault. I think a lot of people are pushing for the notion that you can't just, it's creepy to take one person from one group and say, only listen to this guy, right? And so Tommy, when his book came out, people were kind of pointing out, like, in many ways, what his book is two like a lyrical essay chopped up, put in the beginning, put in the middle. And then it's just a series of like short scenes, not even short stories, that collectively have the effect, the collage effect of a novel. So a couple of people use the word polyphonic for that novel. And people have argued that Bucks and Cocaine is a novel and it's polyphonic. Olivia James, the last piece, I wanted it to be, it's a novella. I purposely made it the size of a novella. So what I tried to do is make them, you know, the shortest to the longest, with the sense that they were all moving in each other's worlds. And it wasn't hard because in some ways it mirrored the actual relationships that were there. But I also wanted to covertly talk a little bit about the Native American writing world. And I know those relationships and those dynamics really, really well. And so there were personalities that I kind of crashed into a little bit, and relationships that I kind of inserted and imagined a world that I had inhabited sort of on the periphery, kind of like Olivia James does. So,
yeah, I love that chapter. As I was reading it, I was like, this is really long. This is the last chapter. And I still had 50 pages to go. And I was so glad, because that was the character that I did want to spend the most time with. Why her for you? Did you intend to spend the most time with her? Was she always going to be the longest chapter, and why?
I don't know when. I actually thought about this a lot, because it was a very strange time for me when I wrote this. I had come to a place of some peace. I had had a disastrous, if you can even call it, relationship. I had come back from, you know, Albuquerque, really, you know, look, I'm very grateful for my job and I love my students. I want to be very clear. But for a Native American woman in her 30s living in rural Illinois, it was really rugged. And, you know, I realized, like, I'm not going to get out right now. And I'm done with this god-awful, if you can even call it, relationship. I'm done processing that. And I want to move on. I just was like, I want to write something new, and I'm going to write about this. And it came so naturally. But I'm having trouble remembering when I realized that in some ways Olivia James is going to be the centralizing character. And what's really funny about it is the guy who did the cover art, Douglas Miles, who's Apache, he's different kind than I am. I'm Chiricahua and he's San Carlos. But Doug, I've known Doug a long time. I love his work and he's done most of my covers. And he was like, you know, I figured out who so-and-so is. And it was kind of disturbing, because I thought I had like really masked who I had modeled these off of. And he was like naming them off. And I'm like, oh God, yes, yes. You know? And he's like, but I can't figure out who that Olivia James is. You know, she's a ballet dancer. I don't know. And I'm like, well, Doug, in many ways, she's me, right? Like, she has a different background than I do. And she has a different way in which she sees her life. But I was also floating in this world on the periphery. And, you know, so I felt like it was kind of honest in a way to end with her, and to sort of take all these characters and put them in her narrative. So at least to some degree or another, so that you could kind of see a perspective that was less kind of, not to say that I can't be absurd, but less absurd, less satiric, right?
Yeah, I loved her. And I loved spending that much time with her. You write a lot of, not only this, but a lot of dark themes generally.
Yeah.
Why do you go there? I mean, I'm not saying that all writing should be happy. I don't believe that at all. I really like dark books, but I imagine it is taxing for the writer. So is it, and why are those the themes that you're drawn to?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I've kind of come around to the place where for some reason it's so compulsive, and it's so, I can't not do it. I'm of several minds of this. And, you know, so one of the things I realized in the last 20 years is that my go-to, and I've started to read the literature again, genre with film is horror. It is literally horror. There'll be sometimes where 3 or 4 months will pass and all I will watch is horror films. And I've read that people with like traumatic childhoods go there because it makes them feel in control. And I'm like, that's interesting, because I don't really need to feel in control except of me in my life, right? And that's the only time that I panic when I'm not in control of me. But I think too, I've realized too that like with my students, I was warning them like, you can't have a thoroughly happy narrative, right? Because what's going to push the character off from their lives in an interesting way to start that inciting incident and to start that acceleration into what's going to be the climactic event, which will change the main character. But similarly, I've had to face, if you just do dark, 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 it is unrelenting. And it is, you know, it on a plot and structure level, it can be really, it can just be boring. You know, like you think you're being deep, you think you're being dark, and really you're just being like plotting, same, same, same. So there is that to consider. And I recently, the novel I was working on, I took out the braided narrative and I made it from a singular point of view. And it allowed me to take the darknesses and recede them to places where it wouldn't overtake the narrative. And it was more structurally bearable and it was more structurally sound because of it. All of that said, I have seen writers who are white and male and straight, and they have been lauded for their unrelenting darkness. And one of the reviews of my first novel, Crazy Horse's Girlfriend, was something like, they called it vulgar several times. I think, you know, that was Publishers Weekly, and then Kirkus was the same, like, you know, actually it's really weird. Their review was almost like, it said something like it was too happy at the end. And yet the other one, it was like, oh, it's vulgar. And I don't know. And so, but most of the time I've gotten, you know, dark, vulgar, when I've had agents and I've been rejected by the Big Five, they'll say it's very dark, you know. Recently an agent rejected the last incarnation of my last novel by saying it was lurid. And
all right, I want to read the lurid version of that. You know?
So I'm like, but I think that some of it has to do with just facing the implied audience being non-Native American, and that's problematic right there for all the reasons. Like, how can you write a good novel when you can't even imagine someone like yourself reading it? Number one, that's just something that's illogical to me. And then number two, you know, it's just problematic because I don't think. Again, I think that being Native American means people just don't want to face up to what they feel is their part in things, right? And so since that's the immediate gut reaction, they won't pay attention to the story, they won't pay attention to the language, they won't pay attention to all the things that every writer I know works so hard to make happen. They only pay attention to their own guilt. And I'm like, you know, conversely, I'm just saying like, you know, don't stop centering yourself. Stop imagining this is about you, and just do what you do with any story, and just read the story and figure out whether you like it or not. You're allowed to do that. You know, if you're filled with white guilt, maybe read an essay and be like, well, okay, you know, I was claiming to be Cherokee, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Or, well, I do live in this all white neighborhood and that's just where I'm going to live. But what am I going to do about it? How am I going to feel about it? Face those things. Let's not like splash it onto every single book by those authors that we read. Right. And so I guess that's some of my issue with that whole thing.
Yeah. No, I'm so glad we got there. A question about dark themes in writing. I think it's so important to talk about how the publishing industry as a machine polices the narratives based on who they can sell it to. And I think we saw a lot of this come out recently with the American Dirt issue. She rolls her eyes, as do I.
Oh, it's just the problem is like it becomes a binary, right? Because that's a problem. You start to become a little bit cuckoo with, am I not a good writer? Or is it that I don't know anymore? And I think that's the problem, is that I want to be free, or at least as free as I can be, to work on my craft, to actually write a good novel. So if it's rejected, I know it's them and not me. And, you know, I feel like, okay, I actually don't have a problem with American Dirt being published. But what I have a problem with is the absolute gigantic fanfare. That's the problem. Like, white people can write whatever they want. And she's not even really white. She's Puerto Rican, right? But to like, right, to pull that out. But there are plenty of Native Americans who, if they said what their official blood quantum is, that you would be like, you know, I know the people would be like, are they really Native American, right? And that's not fair, because a lot of those people would be enrolled citizens of Native American nations, right? So she's Puerto Rican. I have no qualms with that. But I think she didn't stop to think about what her relative privileges meant for how she was writing the novel and what that was going to mean. And like, and I think, you know, for example, like as Elizabeth Warren, a lot of Indians are like, I hate her. And I'm more like, I don't hate her. My problem with her is that if you're going to claim, you know, something that is part of your background and maybe not front and center, you need to take responsibility for it. You need to be like, you can't claim to be white and then be Puerto Rican and then write a book about Mexicans because you're Puerto Rican. And then, you know, similarly with Elizabeth Warren, I have a problem with her checking the box, even though she's not a member, but she never came to Native American meetings. Now she's doing that work, right? A lot of Native Americans won't acknowledge, like, oh, she's not doing the work. She is doing some of the work, but she needed to do it when she was hired. She needed to not prevent other Native Americans from being hired by saying, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm Native American. She needed to come to those Native American meetings. And you know, that's my real issue with it. Like, you need to do the work alongside the claim. And then, you know what? If the art is part of the work and the art's bad, well, that happens, you know? So anyway, so I told you, like, don't give the Indian the mic, you know? So.
No, absolutely give the Indian the mic. This white lady has a platform where she wants to. She wants to give you the mic because that's allyship, right? I don't know. It's performative, I suppose. Oh gosh, I'm in the weeds. Okay, so I want to talk, there's a line in your bio that I read at the beginning about you've been selected as a narrative artist for the Meow Wolf Denver installation. Those are all very new words to me. What is a narrative artist? And what is the Meow Wolf Denver installation? Because it sounds cool.
It turns out, you know, it's funny, like they accepted me and then I put it in my bio and then I went to the last meeting. They're like, don't tell anybody. I'm like, it is really too late. You know, you should have told me that a year ago. But I can tell you loosely about what a narrative artist is and what I can tell you what Meow Wolf is, right? So Meow Wolf is this group of artists, visual artists, who all lived in Santa Fe, and George R. Martin helped fund their buying this old bowling alley and turning it into this giant warehouse of beautiful, surreal, experiential art. So you go, if you Google it, you can see, you go into Meow Wolf in Santa Fe, it's called the House of Eternal Return, and every single room is a different landscape or experience. And you go in and one's a, you know, translucent, beautiful, fairy winged, you know, like alien landscape where there's strange surrealistic sounds coming from everywhere. The next room is like a 80s, like a looks like a room from a 80s teenager's room, right? And then like you'll go into another room and it's all black and white domestic things. And there's a refrigerator and you open the refrigerator and you like slide down the refrigerator into another world. Like it's just this, you know, beautiful, strange experience. But they felt in Santa Fe, where there's such a large Native population, like they weren't as good as they could have been at integrating Natives into, you know, the installation art and into the whole project, especially considering it was wildly successful. And they're opening one in Denver, where I am. They're opening one in Las Vegas, I believe. I think DC. And I keep suggesting LA. I think they should go to LA. But I'm there because they knew they needed to bring more Natives in. And my friend Lee Francis, who's in a Native, you know, bookshop owner and comic book writer and writer, and just all around cool guy, he was like, you know what, if you're going to Denver, you need to hire my friend Erica. So I designed the story behind one of the rooms, and I've been paired with a visual artist who's going to execute the look of it. So, and it's going to be this big, weird, I guess you could say, visual artist and, you know, amusement park in Denver in early 2021, I think.
Cool. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, people are more impressed with that than they are with my books. They're like, oh, yeah, you published 5 books. Then they're like, yeah, well, what? You know, so I'm like, well, you know.
Well, I loved the book. I haven't seen the Meow Wolf installations yet, but I hope they come to Minneapolis.
Yeah, they probably will. Google it and you'll see. They're really cool. So I can get people's excitement.
Yeah. Well, congrats on that collaboration. So besides that, what is next for you? You mentioned a novel recently.
Yeah, I've been working on a kid's book too, just because, you know, for a lot of reasons, I feel like I'd like to see that market get a little more, just like the adult Native American writing world is starting to get a little bit less about, you know, very cool Native things like fry bread and powwow and traditional things and more about just like living day to day as a Native person, so that when you're 4 to 6, that gets in your head real early, as if you're Native or if you're not, you know. But my main project has been working on this novel called White Horse, and I'm trying to get an agent for it. Right now, I kind of had some agents pause because, like I said, I wanted to collapse it down to a singular point of view narrative. But it's about a woman who has always hated her mother, just hated her because she, as far as she knows, her mother abandoned her when she was a couple days old, and it, you know, screwed up her father so badly that he started, he's this very gentle personality, white dude, and he started driving around the streets of Idaho Springs, Colorado, where he's from, just drunk until he got into an accident, which really destroyed his mind. So she was left to take care of her father by the time she was 8 or 9 years old, right? So this letter surfaces when she's in her late 30s that indicates that, you know, something terrible happened in her mother's childhood, and that she doesn't even know, like, oh, is my mother dead or alive? Was she kind of forced to go back to Oklahoma? What happened to my mother? Maybe she's not this evil person that I thought she was. So she and her cousin, who found the letter, go to Oklahoma to try to find out, you know, investigate her mother's murder and find out what happened to her.
That sounds great. Okay, so you're writing that right now, you're doing some edits, and we can expect that next year or two, possibly?
I hope so. It was a collection of short stories, and I then turned it into some cesspool of a novel, and then it really was. And then I turned it into something better, and then I revised it a couple times, and then, like I said, then I realized, like, the braided narrative thing isn't working. I'm always trying to do a more complicated structure, and I just need to give that up, you know, like, especially for this novel. So yeah, I'm hoping that I'll get an agent. I think I'll be done in the next month with this incarnation, and I'm hoping to get an agent in the next month or two, and I'm hoping to hit the big presses now, because they're getting a little more open. It's not just like one Indian at a time, you know? So I'm hoping with this novel that it catches a big press and it's out in a couple of years. So,
well, I know there are some agents that listen to this show. So if you're listening, hit her up.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're winding down. I've just got two more questions for you. The first is, if you have a book to recommend to our audience that's not your own, what would you recommend they check out?
The list is long, and so can I like say two or three?
Yes.
I have to tell you, just I've tried to focus because I'm not a famous or an important writer, but I've been in the community a long time. So I have at least a microphone, even if it's a little tiny Barbie-sized one. So I try really hard to be fair, and I don't, you know, I know what it feels like to not be included. So I'm just going to, lately I've been just trying to stick to adult Native American fiction, right? Not that there aren't great Native poets, and not that there aren't great poets. But I am so ecstatic to see so many contemporary Native American writers finally coming out with big presses from different nations and really just making it happen. I wrote an article for BuzzFeed called like 14 Native American Writers That'll Change Your Life or something, you know, because BuzzFeed likes these clickbaity kind of titles, right? And that's not to denigrate them. They were wonderful with me. The editor I worked with was patient and fabulous and everything. So in any case, some of the books I recommended that are just coming out are Kelly Jo Ford's Crooked Hallelujah. It's about a woman and her mother and their relationship, you know, on the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, and how fraught it is and how much this main character is trying to love her mother and does love her mother desperately, but also just doesn't want to repeat the patterns of her family's past. There's one called Cherokee America by Margaret Verbal. Margaret is not talked about in mainstream Native lit fiction circles, and I don't know why, because she's phenomenal. That one's just a historical fiction about like a certain point in time right after Cherokees had been removed to Oklahoma and what that looked like, and it's engaging and it's so real and visceral. And you know, I'm not a historical fiction person, but this is one of those books where, you know, it's 370 pages and you're like, I've lived in this world, you know, it's like that. Then there's Brandon Hobson, also Cherokee citizen, and his is Where the Dead Sit Talking, about Native Americans in the social work system. Margaret was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Brandon was shortlisted for the National Book Award. So he's right up there alongside Tommy Orange, who again is wonderful, but I just, you know, there he has peers. And then there's a book about to come out, full disclosure, it is my boyfriend's book, but he just got a 2-book deal with Echo HarperCollins for a Native American literary thriller. He's Lakota. And it's about a Native American vigilante on the Lakota Res, and he comes to Denver and it goes back and forth between Denver and the Sichangu Nation, and it's called Winter Counts. And, you know, even if I were not living with him, believe me, this is the kind of book, the kind of thriller that I would pick up and be like, I don't know much about this genre, but I'm going to tear through this. Like, it's just, it's a great read. So yeah, those are some books I would highly recommend.
And what was his name? I didn't catch that.
Oh, sorry, about David Heska Wombly Wyden.
Okay, I'm writing them down. I will link these all in the show notes, including all of your work as well. Anything we talked about, this has been so easy. Thank you for just being a joy to talk to. I mean that sincerely. If we want to connect with you further online, what's the best way to do that?
You know, social media is the easiest. I do have a website, and it's just ericatworth.com. But if you search for me, E-R-I-K-A-W-U-R-T-H, it's a common name, but uncommon spelling. I'm easy to find. I'm on the Twitters. I'm on the Facebooks. And if you join me on Facebook, my mother will inevitably comment on everything that you say on my page. So you'll get that.
Excellent. It's a 2-for-1.
Oh, yes. She'll make sure you know it.
Well, thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh.